Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Come to Newsday on the BBC World Service with Rob Young in London and me, Anne Soy, in Nairobi.
Syria is marking 1 year since the fall of the Assad regime. The head of the United Nations Refugee Agency has warned that Syria is in urgent need of more international assistance. We'll hear from our correspondent in the country.
The shepherd here, Suleiman Kanal, he's got his three boys, and they are all bearing the marks of war. They've all at different times been hurt.
There has been renewed fighting between Thailand and Cambodia along their shared border, with several hundred thousand people forced to evacuate.
Yeah, we'll get an update on that story from Thailand. And in the business, Nick Marsh will tell us about Donald Trump's concerns over Netflix's planned $72 billion deal to buy Warner Brothers Discovery. But we'll start with a bulletin of the latest news.
Hello, I'm Emily Thomas with the BBC News. Several hundred thousand people in Thailand and Cambodia have been ordered to evacuate as a new wave of fighting has erupted between the Southeast Asian neighbours. A Thai soldier was killed during armed clashes along their disputed border. Panisa Amosha from BBC Thai is in Bangkok.
The Thai military has deployed airstrike to target the Cambodian military positions. While in the Cambodia, they said that they have not retaliated against Thailand at the moment. This confrontation is one of the most severe ones ever since the ceasefire back in July. And we have seen images for both Thai sides and the Cambodian sides of people in the borders area that they have to evacuate. A lot of people have to evacuate to shelter.
Celebrations are being held in Syria to mark the first anniversary of the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad and the end of more than five decades of his family's oppressive regime. Hugo Bishega reports.
Crowds have gathered here in central Damascus to mark what for many is Liberation Day. In the past year, President Ahmed al-Sharaa, a former al-Qaeda commander who led the anti-Assad rebels, has worked to consolidate his position as a statesman. Syrians have celebrated their new freedoms, but they still face huge challenges. Families are struggling with the impact of high unemployment and a rising cost of living. Minorities still fear the new authorities, and critics say the government lacks inclusion and transparency.
The outgoing head of the United Nations Refugee Agency has warned that Syria is in urgent need of more international assistance. Filippo Grandi will leave the UNHCR when his second five-year term finishes at the end of this month. He told the BBC that unless reconstruction was accelerated, Syria could go backwards again. Donald Trump claims President Volodymyr Zelensky has not read his proposal on how to end Ukraine's war with Russia. Ukrainian negotiators and Mr. Zelensky have previously objected to plans that suggested Ukraine should hand over some of its territory to Russia and limit its defense capabilities in order to stop the Russian invasion. Mr. Zelensky is due to hold talks on the plan in the UK later on Monday. The BBC's Joel Gunter is in Kiev.
Pivotal talks today for Ukraine in London. President Zelensky will meet Keir Starmer as well as other European leaders, the so-called coalition of the willing. Zelensky will be looking to shore up support around security guarantees, but a striking sort of off-the-cuff interjection by President Trump, who appeared to once again put pressure on Zelensky, saying that he was disappointed in the Ukrainian leader.
Joel Gunter reporting. This is the latest world news from the BBC. Nigeria has said its military helped thwart the attempted coup in Benin on Sunday morning after it asked for help from its neighbour. A statement from the Nigerian president's office said Abuja had sent fighter jets to target the coup plotters who had entered the state TV in Benin's main city, Cotonou, and a military base where they had regrouped. There are reports that at least 13 inmates have been found dead at the Machala prison in southern Ecuador following clashes between rival gangs. Local media say the prisoners from the criminal organisation Los Lobos were asphyxiated. The exact circumstances of the deaths are not clear, but they happened shortly after two explosions were reported near the prison. Tens of thousands of people have rallied in Brazil against gender-based violence. According to a Brazilian NGO, Brazilian Forum on Public Safety, there's been an increase in attacks targeting women in the country. Clícia Sala reports.
Women and some men have marched in cities across Brazil, calling for an end to femicide, rape and misogyny. Some demonstrated wearing green scarves, which are a symbol of the campaign for access to abortion, while others wore stickers that read Machismo Kills. According to a recent report, more than one in three women in Brazil has been a victim of sexual or gender-based violence. While more women are speaking out, they have also been subjected to violent responses from some men.
A woman and a man have been given prison sentences for blackmailing the South Korean football star Son Heung-min. The pair were charged with blackmail and attempted blackmail after extorting $200,000 from Son last year by sending him an ultrasound image of a baby and threatening to reveal him as the father of the child. The Seoul Central District Court sentenced the woman to a 4-year prison term and her ex-boyfriend to 2 years. They've been in custody since May. Son appeared at a closed trial session and gave testimony as a witness last month. BBC News.
Thank you for that news. Hello and welcome to Newsday from the BBC World Service, live from Nairobi with Anne Soy and from London with Rob Young.
Yeah, coming up this hour, we'll head to Damascus, where Syrians are celebrating 1 year since the overthrow of the Assad dynasty. We'll hear about the big challenges that the nation faces as it tries to recover, tries to rebuild from years of civil war.
And you're engaging on this and other stories. Dauda Kamara in The Gambia says as Syrians celebrate 1 year since the fall of Assad dynasty in the country, there's urgent need for the entire citizenry to come together and put their country's needs ahead of personal needs. The government needs to be more inclusive and responsible to the citizens, and the international community should accelerate the reconstruction plans in Syria and celebrate employment opportunities, and rather create employment opportunities for citizens. Happy anniversary to all Syrians. Keep those messages coming. We'll also have the latest from the Thailand-Cambodia border conflict. Our text number is +44 77 86 20 50 85.
So today marks a year since the fall of the Assad regime in Syria and the arrival of a new leader, Ahmad al-Sharaa. Years before, Mr. Sharaa had been labelled a terrorist by the United States, but when he rose to power recently, he was then welcomed in the Oval Office by President Trump. And right now, across Syria, millions of Syrians are celebrating the first anniversary of the overthrow of the Assad dynasty and the end of more than 5 decades of his family's oppressive rule. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, has been to Damascus to examine life in Syria 1 year on.
They're fireworks, though it sounds a bit like the war that used to shake the city when rebels who held the suburbs were trying to break into the centre of Damascus. They're celebrating because it's exactly a year since the fall of Bashar al-Assad, the man who broke Syria to try to save the regime he inherited from his father. I've been to Douma, one of those suburbs, when the regime, helped by the Russians, finally forced the surrender of the rebels in the suburbs in 2018. It looked as if Assad was winning. Ahmed al-Sharaa, who overthrew him 12 months ago, had other ideas.
Just walking around this area, it's still immensely badly damaged. You know, it's been years since there were airstrikes here, but very little's been done to fix it up. You can see signs. People have moved into some flats. There are little brick walls that have been built, walls made of breeze blocks to block up shell holes. Signs of progress. There's so much they have to do.
We drove south from Damascus to Deraa, the town on the border with Jordan where the uprising against the Assad regime started in 2011.
A few enterprising families have clearly been rebuilding their homes, but the vast majority of houses here are still absolutely destroyed, just concrete skeletons. One of Syria's biggest problems, the government says it, the UN says it, is the fact the economy is in such a bad state, collapsed. It's hard to get
economic activity going again in places like this if there are unexploded bombs, unexploded munitions around the in the ruins, in the concrete. So that's another reason, apart from just purely safety, why it's important to try and clean these places up.
My name's Piers Brecker. I'm the location manager for the Halo Trust here.
So just across the road from us, there are a combination of submunitions, anti-personnel mines and anti-tank mines. Next to that, we found a 122mm Grad rockets warhead.
So pretty much, you name it, it's here.
You name it, it's here.
To get rid of it, they place a small explosive charge and from a safe distance, blow it up. A local man has seen the demining team here, and he said there are some very suspicious objects at his property, so we're going to check it out. So the shepherd here, Suleiman Kanar, he's got his three boys, and they are all bearing the marks of war. They've all at different times been hurt. He was shot. He's showing me a huge scar on his leg where he was shot through the right calf. And the boys themselves, they're all bearing marks of where they've been injured by explosions. And also, one of them, Ali, is coughing badly. His lungs have been damaged, I think, by smoke he's inhaled from munitions that they were burning off. The boy's father was relieved that the lethal litter left behind by the war was finally being cleared.
Life is very, very difficult. There's no mercy and comfort in it. My kids were burned twice by gunpowder. This one's face was burned. Look, this one's legs were burned.
Every stop in Syria illustrates another challenge to the new government. We moved on to Beijing, a village in the foothills of the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights, where the problem is Israel. It's in the area Israel is demanding is demilitarized, where the IDF seized more Syrian land after Assad fell. We were in Beijing 3 days after the IDF killed 13 residents of the village in a raid Israel said was an arrest operation. The Damascus government calls it a war crime. 6 IDF soldiers were wounded when local men fought back, forcing a hasty retreat. It's 3 days after the Israeli attack, a significant day in the mourning process. Seems to me these are people, these are villagers who have just been buffeted and trapped by circumstances, the uprising against Assad, the war, unable to control their own lives. And a year on from the fall of Assad, that hasn't changed. It's simply that the forces gripping their lives have changed. The reality of how they live hasn't.
Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen there, who's gone back to Damascus. Now, let's stay in Damascus, and we're now joined by Hugo Bashega, our Middle East correspondent. May I check that you're in Umayyad Square now? How's the day being marked?
This is... events to mark this day will be held... this day, Liberation Day, the day Bashar al-Assad fled the country and 5-decade dictatorship ended. And there is a very festive atmosphere here. There is a huge security operation as well. Today has been declared a public holiday.
We seem to have lost Hugo Bashega there. We'll try and reconnect that line. He is in Damascus reporting about the one-year celebration since the fall of Bashar al-Assad. He is in Damascus, the capital, and our listeners are sending their messages. Dilex Fanbule from Monrovia, Liberia, says that Syria faces more humanitarian crises and needs urgent attention. The UN and other world powers need to step up now so that the people of Syria can hope again. Let's see if we have reestablished that line with Hugo, if you can hear me. We seem to have lost that line. We'll try and reconnect to Hugo a little later. But you're listening to Newsday from the BBC World Service with me, Anne Soy, in Nairobi, and Rob Young in London. A recap of some of our headlines this hour. Thailand says its Air Force has bombed military positions inside Cambodia in the most serious confrontation between the two countries since they signed a ceasefire in July. And a woman who blackmailed the South Korean football star Son Heung-min, claiming she was pregnant, has been sentenced to 4 years in jail. Let's now turn to sport with Isaac Fennin in London.
Yeah, Britain's Lando Norris says winning his first ever Formula One World Championship is the culmination of a dream. His third place finish at the season-ending Abu Dhabi Grand Prix was enough to keep race winner Max Verstappen at bay in the title race that denied the Dutchman a fifth Drivers' Championship in a row. A bad night for Real Madrid as they were beaten 2-0 at home to Celta Vigo and finished the match with nine men as Fran Garcia and Alvaro Carreras were sent off. It also increases the pressure on Real boss Xavi Alonso as they fell 4 points behind Barcelona in the Spanish title race. Manchester City extended their lead at the top of the Women's Super League to 6 points after they won 3-0 at Leicester. And champions Chelsea suffered a shock 1-0 defeat at home to Everton. It was the first defeat in the WSL for Chelsea head coach Sonia Bonpastel in her second season, I should say. And we're also going to hear a little bit later from Wayne Rooney. He says, not live, he looked very excited there. He says that Mo Salah is destroying his legacy after explosive comments that the Egyptian made over the weekend, where he accused Liverpool of throwing him under the bus.
Look forward to that. Isaac, thank you very much indeed. Let's cross to Singapore now, speak to our business presenter, Nick Marsh, about that big mega deal we discussed last week. Netflix buying Warner Brothers, a real moment in the world of entertainment where an online giant buys a century-old movie studio. Donald Trump, though, has weighed in, and he's not all that happy about it.
He's not all that happy, Rob. I think he was listening to you last week because you brought this problem up, didn't you, about monopolies and too big a market share. I think he's been taking a leaf out of your book. He said
heads of state listening to this program. It wouldn't surprise me, Nick.
It would not surprise me, and a shout out to all of them listening now. The deal could be a problem, he says, because, like you said, the merger could violate antitrust laws. Outside the US, they're called anti-competition, anti-monopoly laws. You can understand where he's coming from. I mean, we discussed it last week. Lots of people predicted this. This is a huge, huge deal, $72 billion. The issue, though, would be that Netflix would suddenly have HBO Max. So you'd have all these big shows like Game of Thrones, Succession, White Lotus, and all of that on the same platform. Donald Trump says that could be too large a market share. He's not the only one. Democrats even, in Congress have got this issue that, too much of the market's going to be cornered by one big company. And they're also worried from the consumer point of view that subscription prices might go up. Where else do you go? Where's the competition? And also there might be reductions in the entertainment industry when it comes to jobs as well, if one company is basically in charge of so much of the entertainment being produced in America.
Mm. And Donald Trump, though, he's the president. He wouldn't ordinarily decide whether a company is allowed to take another company over. There are executive bodies in the United States that do that. But this is the Donald Trump presidency. Do we know what's likely to happen, what the process is likely to be?
Well, look, he said, I'm going to be personally involved in the decision making. Doesn't mean he's going to make the final decision, but he's going to very much be involved in this. The Department of Justice is scrutinizing this deal. It's going to take a very, very long time. But Donald Trump, he's personally involved with some of the people in this whole acquisition. So you've got one of the bidders that Netflix beat in terms of its bid, which is Paramount Skydance. They're run by David and Larry Ellison. Larry Ellison, really big vocal Trump supporter, multi billionaire. But he's also been meeting with Ted Sarandos, the Netflix chief executive, and Donald Trump was actually pretty effusive about him, saying that he'd revolutionized movies and entertainment. So you've got that sort of Donald Trump factor there as well. But you've also just got the arguments for and against whether this does violate antitrust laws. Netflix is basically saying, you shouldn't just look at other streaming competitors. Yes, HBO is a competitor, but you need to widen the definition of what competition means. You need to include things like TikTok, YouTube. You know, if the market is basically just one of your attention, then our market share is going to be decreasing significantly. But any decision though, Rob, I mean, we're talking late 2026 at the earliest anyway. So this could go on for a while.
All right. Nick, thanks very much indeed. A few hours ago, Thailand said it had launched a series of airstrikes on the military in neighbouring Cambodia after claiming that its troops came under fire. Cambodia, however, claims the violence was launched by Thailand and said it hadn't retaliated. While in response to the violence, several hundred thousand people in the border area have been ordered to evacuate. This is a significant escalation between the two nations, who agreed a ceasefire, partly brokered by Donald Trump, after a five-day war in July. Well, early on, I got the latest from Panisa Amochi from the BBC's Thai service.
Both sides still accusing each other of first opening shot. At the moment, according to Thai army, we have heard that at least one Thai soldier was dead and also four are wounded. Peoples along four districts of the border from the Thailand side have to evacuate it. We are talking about almost 400,000 people that have to be displaced. Earlier today, I have talked to one of the school teacher who also live in the red zone, the zone that is officially have to be evacuated. And he expressed concerns about school that have to be shut. And we are talking about the future of students, not only for the Thai side, but along with the Cambodian side that need to evacuate it from this intensified fighting between the two countries.
And at heart of this military clash, renewed since that ceasefire in July, is a disputed border.
It is. So ever since the two countries agree on the ceasefire that brokered by Malaysia's Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim and witnessed by US President Donald Trump, the people on the local have told me that they still feel so fragile and the ceasefire is feel so volatile that it can be violated and it can be stopped at any time. So at the moment, people from the two countries are really wanting the third party, whether it be the Malaysians or whether it be the external authorities, to really help facilitate and to really help negotiate the conflict that has been spanning ever since July.
And so is this a heavily militarized area because of that border dispute? Are there a lot of soldiers and other parts of the military in those two parts of the countries?
It is, because according to the Thai army, they already deploy aircraft. They mentioned that this is only for rule of engagement to suppress continued attack, and it is very specific target to the military of to suppress the Cambodian side. But the Cambodians also refute that their troops had not retaliated. But we have seen troops from both sides really stationed along those borders area.
Yeah, although the Thai army has said that one soldier has died and eight other military personnel have been injured. And I think the Cambodians have said there have been injuries on their side as well, haven't they?
Yeah, we have seen the Cambodians also express their point of view. I have not have the number of what they claim of the facility and also the wound number of the soldier from the Cambodian side yet.
You mentioned that Malaysia was also instrumental in this ceasefire agreement that was signed back in July. What efforts are now being made then to try to stop the fighting?
Yeah, I mean, for the two countries, we're still waiting to see. But as of this morning, Malaysia's Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim already expressed concern about this intensifying situation. In the part, we have seen that when he expressed concern, he will later in the day or at night trying to have a phone in with the head of the state, with the Prime Minister of both Thailand and Cambodia. So we might see that happening tonight as well.
That was my colleague there from the BBC Thai service, Panisa Emochi. There's a live page running on this story on the BBC website at bbc.com, where one of the most recent updates is some video of people fleeing that border area. This video I've just been looking at is from the Cambodian side, where people have got as much as they can carry on various carts, and they're moving away from that border area as they have been ordered on both sides of that border.
Let's now return to that story on Syria, where celebrations are taking place 1 year since the fall of the regime of Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad. After decades of repression and civil war, much of the country is in ruins and millions of people have been made refugees. But the country is celebrating today. Zaher Sahloul is a native of Syria and the president of the international NGO Med Global. He joins us from Dubai. Welcome to the program. Just tell us how important this moment is for the country, that people are celebrating freedoms.
Thank you for having me. And this is a happy day for Syrians, not only Syrians, but all people who love freedom. The war started because people wanted to have freedom. And miraculously, 1 year ago, we had an end of a regime that I lived under its oppression for the past 60 years of my life. The father of the current, of the last president, Hafez al-Assad, then his son, Bashar al-Assad, who committed a human rights violation that are uncounted, displaced half of the population, destroyed half of the country, used chemical weapons, attacked hospitals, and made the country going backward more than 50 years. I was in Syria 3 days ago. People are very hopeful. They're happy. They're in the streets. I visited the Christian quarter in Damascus, and it's very festive. This is the first time I see festivities for the coming holidays in that amount. So people are hopeful and happy that the good days to come in Syria.
Good days to come, but there are still many challenges on the ground. What are some of the, what is the humanitarian situation there?
It's horrible. You know, after 14 years of war and displacement of half of the population, and now you had more than 1.5 million who came back to Syria, but you still have a very collapsed economy. You have hyperinflation. Still people want to leave Syria, especially young people who want to have jobs. Also, of course, the instability in some areas in Syria, in the south, in Suweida, in the northeast, and in the Sahel. So people wanted to have stability first. They wanted to have prosperity. They want to give this current government a chance. And I think most Syrians believe that the current government has the best chance to stabilize the situation. But the challenges are huge. I visited some of the hospitals in Homs and Hama, and they need a lot of work. The healthcare system need to be rebuilt. Investment need to be brought. The sanctions now is out, but it will take some time to recover and rebuild what has been destroyed.
And what kind of support is needed to help with that rebuilding?
I think the most important thing that paying attention to Syria, you know, usually after a war, the international community lose attention. Syria still need a lot of hope. We understand that there is a huge need in Ukraine and Gaza and Sudan, but Syria still need to have a lot of support. The World Bank estimated that Syria needs $210 billion to rebuild what has been destroyed. Investment, an international conference for pledging to stabilize Syria. Now that the sanction is lifted, we need to have companies that create jobs to the population. We need to make sure that we don't lose this momentum, because this milestone happened once in a lifetime, that we have a country that ended a brutal regime and it's now wanted to be stable and peaceful with all of its neighbor. And I think the whole international community has to support this transition.
And you are talking about your country from the outside. And when you look at what is going on there, do you feel a sense of hope?
Well, you know, I mean, I've been in Syria after the change of the regime 6 times. And before that, I used to go to Idlib and Aleppo in medical missions in the north, in what's called at that time the liberated areas. So I've seen the evolution and I've seen the happiness. You know, when you go to the street and talk to the people in Homs and Damascus and Aleppo and Daraa and other places, you know, you feel that they are emotional. For the first time, they can talk and criticize the regime, and they can organize and go to the street and demonstrate without anyone, shooting at them. There's no talk about torture and prisons. So if the people are hopeful and supportive, we are hopeful. But we need the attention of the international community to rebuild what has been destroyed.
Thank you very much for speaking to Newsday. Zaher Sahloul, a Syrian living in Dubai. Stay with Newsday if you can.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the U.S. is made possible by American Public Media, producer and distributor of award-winning public radio content, engaging audiences, creating meaningful experiences, and fostering conversations. APM, American Public Media, with support from Wealth Enhancement, offering its Wealth Blueprint, a plan integrating retirement, investing, tax strategies, and more. Learn more at wealthenhancement.com/blueprint.
The Supreme Court hears oral arguments on a case that could expand the president's power and erode the power of some regulatory agencies. The case was brought by an FTC commissioner fired by President Trump. A district court concluded that firing was unlawful, but the Supreme Court's conservative majority has already signaled a willingness to overturn that decision. That's on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition begins 2 a.m. every weekday morning on KQED News.
Hello, you're with Newsday from the BBC World Service with Anne Soy in Nairobi and Rob Young in London.
In Ivory Coast, President Alassane Ouattara is being inaugurated for a fourth term in office. We hear from a former prime minister.
Donald Trump's ongoing clampdown on migrants in America is fueling criticism of his policy of deporting people to third countries.
And why is Finland focusing on its defense and security issues? But first, this news.
BBC News with Emily Thomas. Several hundred thousand people in Thailand and Cambodia have been ordered to evacuate as a new wave of fighting has erupted between the Southeast Asian neighbours. Thailand says its air force has bombed military positions inside Cambodia following armed clashes along their disputed border. Celebrations are being held in Syria to mark the first anniversary of the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad, ending his family's five-decade-long regime. He fled to Russia as rebels commanded by Syria's new president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, seized Damascus. Nigeria said its military helped thwart the attempted coup in Benin on Sunday morning after it asked for help from its neighbour. Abuja said it had sent fighter jets to target the coup plotters. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is due to hold talks with European leaders in London later about how to end the war with Russia. President Zelensky will be seeking their support in persuading Washington to provide security guarantees for Ukraine in the event of a deal. Earlier, Donald Trump expressed frustration with Mr. Zelensky, claiming he had not read his peace proposal. Tens of thousands of people have rallied in cities across Brazil against gender-based violence and misogyny. An NGO in Brazil says last year nearly 1,500 women were victims of femicide. A woman and a man have been given prison sentences for blackmailing the South Korean football star Son Heung-min. The pair were charged with blackmail after extorting $200,000 from Son last year by sending him an ultrasound image of a baby and threatening to reveal him as the father. A water leak at the Louvre Museum in Paris has damaged hundreds of books just weeks after jewels worth more than $100 million were stolen. The museum said between 300 and 400 works were affected by the leak, which happened in late November, and that the count was ongoing. World News from the BBC.
Thank you for that news. Hello and welcome to Newsday with Anne Soy in Nairobi and Rob in London. This half hour will go to Ivory Coast, South Africa and Finland.
Yeah, and Isaac will be here with more sport news for you. How the British Formula One driver Lando Norris achieved his lifetime ambition by, he says, winning it his way.
And his mother says it's overwhelming, emotionally draining. And she also adds that we backed Lando during all the good and bad times. As always, we welcome your messages. Send them to our text number +447 786 2050 85.
Well, let's head to West Africa now, where Alassane Ouattara will be sworn in for a fourth term as president of Ivory Coast. He's been in power since 2011 and won re-election in a vote that excluded his two main rivals. This has prompted criticism from opposition figures about concerns around democratic norms. But supporters highlight his record on economic growth and infrastructure, while critics point to rising inequality. We're joined now by Patrick Atchi, a former Prime Minister of Ivory Coast and now a special advisor to the President. Welcome to Newsday.
Thank you, Rob.
Does the President, on the day of his fourth inauguration, lack a certain element of legitimacy, given that his two main rivals were barred from running and only half of Ivorians turned out to vote?
No, I don't think so. I think Cote d'Ivoire is stable, peaceful and democratic. And this inauguration just confirms it. It's just the conclusion of a fully democratic process through which the Ivorian people have been able to express fairly and transparently and peacefully their will. It is important to know that, the people were able to process the vote and pick up who they want. The other parties, the political parties, were allowed to present any candidates they wanted to present. And the one that were not legitimate as far as the legal process was concerned were not admitted to the election. But there were four other candidates, and he was picked up out of four. So we think it's a free and fair election. I mean, it's really quite a change since what we've known for the past 15 years. It's really peaceful. More than 50% of the people have been able to go to the voting booth. And this is the type of rate that you find in, most of the countries around as far as election of presidential election is concerned.
You say the election was fair, yet Tidiane Thiam, who was the leader of the main opposition party, the Democratic Party of Ivory Coast, was barred from running in the election.
He was not barred for running for the election, first of all. There's rules in the elections, You have to be fully Ivorian, have no other nationalities. He has two nationalities, and, by the time the deadline was set up for the candidacy.
He renounced his French citizenship, which he was given in 1987, in March. The election was in October. That was plenty time for you to get your records in order. You only renounced your French citizenship this year, yet you'd been prime minister for years.
He had 1 year to renounce his nationality. After he got president to the party, he knew he was going to run. He didn't renounce his nationality. The deadline was there. There was not plenty of time. Time is set up by rules. You don't fix the time you want to do things, He had 1 year, fully a year to do it. He didn't do it. By the time he did it, it was too late. So I don't know. For us, it's just fair.
Well, Tidiane Thiam, who was a very well-respected international business leader and many Ivorians had hoped would become president of the country, has talked about Ivory Coast's drift towards a total absence of democracy. Can you say genuinely when a man who many Ivorians wanted to run was chosen by the main opposition party to run and then was barred from, there may be a legal basis for it, but many people regard it as politically motivated. Can you really say the country is a genuine democracy?
But I don't know why rules are followed in a country, in a developing country. You feel that it's injustice or it's not legal just because, it's a developing country. In any country in the world, if you do not fulfill the legal process that needed for you to be a legitimate candidate, you're barred from going, So why? Because it's Cote d'Ivoire. You come up, whatever experience he has, whatever quality he has, there is a law and you should just follow the rule of law. And
when most laws are enacted, there is a right to appeal. This decision was not able to be appealed, was it?
I don't understand that. I mean, it's very difficult for us, Just when you step in Africa and another developing country, you want to find argument anywhere else but the law.
I'm putting you the argument of Ivorians. This decision, though, couldn't have been appealed, could it? There was.
You have to respect the law.
Did you hear my question? Because you're not answering it. This decision, though, to bar Tidiane Thiam from running, could not be appealed legally.
Every single issue could be appealed legally. It has to be just following, as I say, the rule. If you don't follow the rule, then you cannot be a candidate. And it's not the only one. The second thing is that if he cannot be candidate, the party was allowed to have other candidates. Why did he put any other candidates from his party? And he say, if I'm not legitimate and I cannot run, then no one is going to run from the party. Is that a democratic process within his own party? Can you understand that? That the whole party is not running because one guy is barred because he has not been able to meet the legal conditions.
Now, Alassane Ouattara changed the constitution so that he could run a third time. He then has chosen to run and has won a fourth term. Do you think he would like to stand for a fifth term as well?
I mean, you know, the constitution right now doesn't allow for another term. So as long as we are within this actual constitution, I don't think it's going to go for another term.
So you won't change the constitution again then?
Why should you change
constitution? We changed it once before.
It's not him who is changing, you know. It went through a legal process once again. It's not him who is changing, but the people of Cote d'Ivoire who is changing the constitution, whether they feel they want to change it.
Now, we spoke to somebody who runs a cocoa farmers cooperative earlier on the programme, who was talking about all of the lorries of cocoa beans which are blocking the ports because farmers don't wish to sell at the current price. You're a former prime minister. You were in charge of an awful lot of economic and infrastructure policies. You're now a special advisor to the president. What will the government do to help those cocoa farmers sell their beans at a price they regard as fair?
But I think the prices that they are given is the price which is fair. It's more than 60% of the world market price, which is, you know, what is, you know, currently used every year. Even it was even beyond what, you know, they were expecting. I think that is very a small issue that is actually creating a problem in the port. It's very circumstantial issues that are being dealt with actually with from the Minister of Transport. It's going to be solved. You know, we've had a very good price. Most of the farmers have sold the cocoa very early. And then, you know, it's been a little creating a little bit of blockage. That's right. But it has been dealt with. And I think that's not a major issue for a country that has been doing so well in the past 15 years. As you know, Alassane Ouattara, since he's been on the power for now, we've been having 7% average growth every year, sustainable and inclusive growth that are reduced poverty from 55% he found in 2011 to less than 37%. In the next 5 years, we're going to have less than 20%. So economic performance of being worldly acknowledged, being great. People are really happy. The country is stable. We have security. Everything is going so fine. And this is not what we've witnessed 16 years back. We're coming from very far, you know, away. And we should be really, everybody is happy where we are right now and where we're heading.
If you're listening in Cote d'Ivoire, want to take issue with any of that, do get in touch. You know the text number, +447786205085. Patrick Achi, former Prime Minister, advisor to President Alassane Ouattara. Thanks very much for joining us.
To South Africa now, and the claim that white farmers in South Africa are being deliberately targeted by violent criminals remains one of the country's most sensitive issues. This year, US President Donald Trump intensified the debate by calling the situation a genocide and prioritizing refugee applications from white Afrikaners. Over 26,000 murders overall have been recorded in South Africa last year, with a majority concentrated in urban areas. South Africa rejects the claim of genocide, but the White House's intervention has cast dividing lines throughout the Afrikaner community, as Africa Eye's Claire Mawisa reports. And just a note, you may find or you may hear some distressing content.
Set amidst the rolling grasslands of the Highveld Plateau, Martinez's farm feels isolated. A few other lonely farmsteads dot the horizon around us. He earns a decent living, but he no longer believes his family has a future here.
I always had that thing in my mind that when they gonna come and kill us or torture us.
He's applied for refugee status in America, concerned that his wife and children could one day fall victim to a farm murder. It's a fear grounded in personal tragedy.
Now he came into my grandpa's bedroom and then he hammered that shotgun on my grandfather's face. My grandfather stand up again and then he shot him two times in his head.
Brutal, often high-profile murders of white farmers have fueled the belief that the killing of Afrikaners amounts to genocide.
It's a genocide that's taking place that you people don't want to write about, but it's a terrible thing that's taking place and farmers are being killed. They happen to be white, but whether they're white or black makes no difference to me.
Black people were forced off their land by the government under apartheid. Decades after its end, white South Africans still own the majority of privately owned farmland. But Donald Trump's claim of genocide has proven divisive, even amongst those he's offering to protect.
See, there the fence is complete, there it's been cut. But that's another clear sign that there's somebody in here right now as we speak.
We join Morgan Barrett on a nighttime patrol of his farm. Like many white farm owners, Morgan employs black South African security guards, and black workers are frequently amongst the victims of farm attacks.
I think the people who are calling it a white genocide have no real understanding of what a genocide is. If they thought that the black guy had 20,000 rand sitting in a safe, they'd attack him just as quickly as they'd attack the white guy with 20,000 in the safe.
Morgan tells us he has no intention of leaving, but even if the claims of genocide are ill-founded, the chance at a new life in America remains tempting.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Mama.
Carlene and her children relocated after their farm was burgled. She's been unemployed for 10 years. Now Donald Trump's offer could see her family divided. She's determined to go, but her daughter Vilma wishes to stay.
Every morning when they go to school, I worry, is something happening? My biggest challenge is to find a decent job where I don't have to fight every day for my income.
Older generation, white people still feel that race thing, like they're scared of black people. Black people constantly need to show, listen, I'm safe. I have high hopes for the younger generation. We'll make it work.
Carlene submitted her application and has been advised to complete more paperwork. Back in the Highveld, Martinez and his family have had their application approved. They now prepare to leave their home as recognized refugees.
Africa Eye's Claire Mawisa reporting there. For more on this story, please search for The White Asylum, America's South African Refugees, on the BBC News Africa YouTube channel. Let's now turn to sport with Isaac Fannin in London.
Lando Norris won the F1 World Championship for the first time.
It's Lando who's delivered the performances when it's most mattered. Round the final corner, Max Verstappen will take victory in Abu Dhabi, but the championship will go the way of the man you can hear now, Lando Norris, a corner away from becoming 2025 Formula One world champion. He crosses the line and into history. Lando Norris is champion in 2025.
Lando, this is Zach from McLaren. Is this the world champion hotline?
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, you heard Zach Brown, the chief executive of McLaren, congratulating his driver Lando Norris, who was incredibly emotional as he etched his name in Formula One history. The 26-year-old doing exactly what he needed to do in the last race of the season in Abu Dhabi, finishing third, which ensured he beat Max Verstappen to the title by 2 points to lift the Drivers' Championship.
When I know how much hard work's gone into it, how much everyone around me has pushed me, has kicked me to kind of get the best out of me at times, because they believed I could do it more than I myself. And, you know, they were the ones who believed in me the most, and they made me perform at the level I needed to do, and I couldn't thank everyone else enough.
Yeah, congratulations to Lando Norris. Wayne Rooney says that Mohamed Salah is ruining his legacy at Liverpool after the forward accused the club of throwing him under the bus for a third game in a row. Salah was left on the bench, but this time he didn't come on at all. Afterwards, he made some eye-catching comments after the match against Leeds, and he said his relationship with coach Arne Slot had broken down. This is what Rooney had to say.
To have the arrogance to say that he doesn't have to earn his place because he should play, he's already earned his place. You need to be at your best every week to try and stay in your team. That's part of being in a team sport. And if I was one of his teammates, I wouldn't be happy at all with what he said, because this is where Liverpool need the most. And if anything, he's turned Liverpool under the bus.
Yeah, you can hear more from Rooney by tuning into the Wayne Rooney Show, which is on the BBC Sports YouTube page. And wherever you get your podcasts. In the Women's Super League, as Chelsea lost for the first time in almost 3 years, they were beaten 1-0 by Everton. Sonia Bonpastor had never lost a match managing against an English side as her manager of Chelsea, having won the domestic treble last season. But her side huffed and puffed, 30 shots on goal, 18 corners and 61 touches inside Everton's box. But they fell to a 1-0 defeat.
The ball hit the post 2 times and the crossbar 3 times. Probably also we had one of 2 situations where the ball was probably not far from going in. Again, I think it would have been good to have the technology again tonight in the game. But yeah, that's the only thing we can say.
As ever, bbc.com/sport for all your latest sports news.
Isaac, thanks very much indeed. Now, media reports in Nigeria are saying that the government has managed to secure the release of 100 students who were kidnapped from a Catholic boarding school in Niger State last month when armed men stormed the school and kidnapped more than 300 students. There's been no official confirmation yet, but we can speak to the BBC's Medina Mashani, who joins us from Abuja. What is the latest that we do know?
So the latest that we know right now is last night I spoke to the Commissioner of Police of Niger State and the proprietor of St. Mary's School. That is where the children were abducted. And they both confirmed to me that 100 students have been rescued by security forces and that they got that information from the Office of the National Security Advisor. Both of them have not seen the children yet, but it's still indeed difficult to confirm if this is actually true, but they said they got the information from that office and that the children will be brought back to their parents in batches starting from today, Monday. So that is what we have right now. And the Commissioner of Police also told me that, you know, there was a negotiation involved, but he's not sure of the details because he wasn't part of the rescue operation. But we know that the children have been rescued according to them.
Okay, so there was some kind of negotiation then, but we don't know whether any kind of ransom was paid.
No. There's no talks of ransom and, you know, no group has actually come out to own up to the abduction, so no.
And if this story is correct that 100 have been released, we know that 300 were originally taken, some had managed to escape initially. Does that mean that still a large number remain hostage?
Yes, so initially 303 students were taken from the school and 12 teachers. So 50 were said to escape, and then another 100 yesterday were rescued. So that leaves about 165 students still with their captors and the 12 teachers.
And when this happened and in the weeks that followed it, there was a spate of other mass kidnappings in the country. We heard various initiatives announced by the government, such as hiring new police officers, redeploying some security personnel. What has been happening recently? Has the number of kidnappings reduced?
So after the one in Niger, there was, you know, before the one in Niger, there was one in Kwara State and also another one in Niger. There were still a few other ones. There were not, you know, the numbers were not high. I think there was one in another state with about 10 or so. I'm not too sure of the details, but there were still a few that happened after Niger, but they were not too significant like the one in Niger.
All right. Thanks very much indeed. That's the BBC's Medina Mashani there joining us from Abuja. We would, of course, keep you up to date on that story once when there is official confirmation later on throughout the day.
Let's now go to Finland, which shares quite a long border with Russia, over 1,300 kilometres. In 2023, the Finnish government closed all border crossings between the two countries and also joined NATO. And in the aftermath of Russia's attack on Ukraine, a record number of women volunteered to do military service. Conscription is mandatory for men, but not for women. Lieutenant Colonel Annukka Jilivaara is a Finnish woman leader, the first one to serve a battalion as battalion commander in the army. She's also the Assistant Secretary General on the Secretariat of Finland's Security Committee. She spoke to me a little earlier.
Whatever the end result is, we are continuing with our preparedness measures and, of course, planning for the worst also.
And in making all those preparations for even a potential large-scale attack, as you say, what kind of measures that are being taken in Finland?
Well, overall, I think it's necessary to explain our preparedness ideology, because in Finland we use comprehensive security approach, which means that we have defined vital functions of society, and these vital functions range from leadership to international EU activities, defense capability, internal security, economy, infrastructure and security of supply, functional capacity of the population services, and psychological resilience. So we look at the society quite holistically, and also the threat spectrum in our case is quite vast, not only concerning military threats. And how do we safeguard these vital functions in any case, whether it's been normal times or during times of crisis? We need cooperation between authorities, business community, organizations and citizens. The ideology is to be able to safeguard Finland, whatever the situation is. In Finland, there are only 5.6 million people living, and if we look at the European context, our territory is relatively large. So we need everybody to participate.
How is the public responding to all these calls from you for everybody to participate?
Well, if we look at the polls that are made annually, because annually we ask, for example, a citizen's attitude in relation to their will to participate in defending the country. And according to those results, roughly 80% of those who answered said that they think that Finland should defend itself in military means, and a little more than 80% thought that they would be themselves willing to participate in defending Finland.
And when you enlisted in the military in 1999, women didn't typically do the kind of thing that you're doing now, and I think you have said there were only two women in your unit at that time. Has the war in Ukraine changed that perspective? Are you seeing more women enlisting?
If I remember it right, I think the record year of women enlisting was 2021, so roughly 1,700 women were enlisting. But this year, the number was 1,450, something like that. So roughly the amount has been the same. It is difficult to assess whether it has affected particularly to women's willingness. I think that overall, those youngsters who are starting their service have been quite motivated, because now they think that it is more than before possible that they would have to actually use those skills that they are trained in the Finnish Defence Forces.
Tell us more about these women who are enlisting, hundreds of them, their age, walks of life, professions. Have you seen any trends?
Well, overall, if we look at the situation and compare those who started their service in 1995, when the first possibility came to start voluntary military service for women, so overall, during that time, women were a couple of years older than nowadays. Nowadays, they are more at the same age as men who start their service. One characteristic is probably high motivation. So they are highly motivated to participate and to learn those skills that are trained in the defense forces. Otherwise, I think it'd be difficult to answer to this question.
And in May 2022, just a few days before Finland applied to join NATO, you became the first woman to lead a Finnish battalion. How important was that? And do you expect more women to follow in your footsteps?
Well, personally, of course, that was an important assignment. It was really an honor to start as a battalion commander. So personally, it was a big step. Certainly, I expect that there will be more women starting in battalion commander or even higher positions, because the amount of women in the defense forces are increasing. And we have to remember that there has been only 30 years since the first women started their military service. So it takes time to reach certain positions.
Lieutenant Colonel Annukka Ylivaara there from the Finnish Army.
We told you earlier on about Syrians marking the first year since the fall of the Assad dynasty. Well, if we take you live to Damascus, to central Umayyad Square. you can hear the thousands and thousands of flag-waving Syrians who gathered there to mark this important day. That is it for this edition of Newsday. Thank you for listening.
In such a chaotic year, where did you find beauty? I'm Gabe Moline, editor for KQED's Arts and Culture Desk, and we've been looking back at uplifting moments from 2025. The kindness of strangers, a sweet rendezvous, the joys of community. We're calling it One Beautiful Thing, a series of essays about special, personal moments from the year. Find it online at kqed.org/arts.
And this week in our political breakdown newsletter, Guy Marzorati looks at how Democrats are working to make health care a defining issue in next year's midterms, all the way down to the candidates they recruit now. Find out more in our political breakdown newsletter. Find that wherever you find your newsletters on KQED. We've got lots of them at kqed.org/newsletter. This is KQED San Francisco.